and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com. Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign. 10,000 Villages' 18th annual showcase of heirloom quality oriental rugs will be held March 10th through the 13th at their store. There will be an informational seminar about oriental rugs on Thursday, March 11th at 7 p.m.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. When you hear the name Isaac Newton, do you picture apples falling from trees? You think of Newton as the scientist who discovered the laws of motion and gravity. While there are many other accomplishments that may come to mind, he is described as the founder of modern science. But did you know that in addition to his accomplishments in science, he also tracked down criminals, and that he played a role in the development of the modern banking system? This afternoon, we're going to talk with science writer Thomas Levinson. His latest book is Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. Levinson notes in the opening of his book that Isaac Newton's career at Trinity College, Cambridge, lasted 35 years. Then in 1696, he was launched on a second career. He was named Warden of the Royal Mint. The counterfeiter of the title is William Chaloner. He proved quite a foe for Isaac Newton. Questions and comments this afternoon, listeners, are invited for our guest, Thomas Levinson. I look forward to your phone calls. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thomas Levinson heads the graduate program in science writing at MIT. He's also a Peabody Award-winning documentary filmmaker. His new book, Newton and the Counterfeiter, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thomas Levinson, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So how did you learn of Isaac Newton's second career?
Well, I was working on quite a long time ago, about 15 years ago, I was working on a completely different project, a history of science told through musical instruments as well as scientific instruments. And I reached the point, you know, if you start in the Greeks and go to the present day, you sort of run through Newton along the way. And I reached a point where I had to sort of talk about Newton. And it turned out that, as you say, he did a lot of things. One of the things he tried to do was both work out a musical scale that was properly tempered or balanced. And he tried to map his colors of the rainbow, the you know, colors you see in the prism that he used to make some of his most important discoveries. He tried to map those against a musical scale. So I was writing about all this and, you know, all these kinds of things. And I found, as I was looking through just the Newton literature, I found this really odd thing. It was a letter from a condemned man sitting in the sort of the death cells or waiting to die in Newgate Jail, a notorious prison in the center of London. And it was written to Newton, begging him for his life. Oh, dear sir, pity me. If you do not do this thing for me, I will be murdered. Please save me. You know, it was this terrible human cry of despair at the prospect of imminent, you know, grotesque death. I mean, they killed people in painful ways back then. And I was, you know, a proper human being would have some sympathy for this agony, even though it was really a very bad guy writing this letter. But as a writer, I got really curious right away. You know, why was Newton in correspondence with a man sitting waiting to be executed? And it turned out that the author of that letter was William Chaloner, the person I ultimately found out much more about. And that led me to Newton's whole second career as a very important official in Britain's just sort of starting civil service, especially financial civil service, and as this, you know, currency cop.
Yeah. Newton produced a tremendous amount of writing in his scientific work. Was that also true of his time at the Royal Mint?
It was. There are five large folios of handwritten documents in the British archives still, written in Newton's hand, most of them, of all kinds of things, memos, accounts, responses to inquiries, designs for medals. I mean, he actually got, one of the things the Mint did was have, you know, commemorative medals for victories or coronations or something. And he got involved in that, too. He actually got his hands dirty trying to design these things. So he was a very, very hard worker, and he was one of these people who, you know, even if he didn't want to do a job originally, and he didn't want to chase counterfeiters, he tried to get out of it. Once he was told that as warden of the Mint, he had to be a cop, he couldn't get out of it, he threw himself into it with this sort of ferocious dedication.
Yeah, and how did his intellect serve him in his role as warden of the Royal Mint?
Newton was the smartest man alive, and one of the great, great intellectual figures in history, of course. And he brought his brain to bear on all his tasks. So he was by far the most rigorous warden the Mint really had ever seen. One of the things that was going on during Newton's first years at the Mint was there was a terrible currency crisis, and it's actually important to the book. It's one of the reasons there was such a fabulous opportunity for counterfeiters to make false money, because so little good, real, legal money was in circulation for a variety of reasons. And the solution that had been proposed and finally authorized just as Newton was getting to the Mint was to take in all the silver money that was in circulation in England. And silver was the medium. It was a silver-based currency at that time, not gold. Take all this in, millions of pounds worth of shillings and half-crowns and crowns, melt them all down and remint them in a counterfeit-proof and fully legal, full-weight, you know, fine, finished product as this sort of a whole new coinage. And Newton did this extraordinary thing. He did a time and motion study, perhaps the first one on record, trying to see how many men and how many horses it would take to produce a given number of coins from a given amount of metal. He did analyses of how the melting of metal and the forming of assays should work. He did very precise calculations of the accounts and worked out, you know, how much it should cost per pound of silver to turn that, you know, per pound weight of silver to turn that into English currency and so on and so forth. And you can really see both his deep knowledge of melting metal, which came from his secret alchemical work. That's where he really derived that base of experience. And just the sheer, you know, intellectual rigor. You know, he wasn't just going to sort of do it by guess and by God. He was going to sit down there and observe and take notes and calculate. It's a very familiar Newton when you see him in that part of his role at the Mint. It's you know, he is the man who figured out hard problems.
It's so fascinating that Isaac Newton was interested in alchemy, and he was at it for 20 years.
Well, alchemy did have a bad reputation in Newton's time. There's no doubt about it. There was a plague in 1620, so you know, more than two decades before Newton was even born, by Ben Jonson called The Alchemist, which treated alchemists as fraudsters, you know, people who are trying to con the innocent and you know, counterfeit money. But at the same time, there was a long tradition of sort of elite esoteric studies, and Newton was very much part of it. So were some other very famous people, Robert Boyle, the pioneering chemist, John Locke, the political philosopher. I mean, these are names you don't think of as either con men or you know, people trying to rip off, you know, the gullible. And they were in it for a very specific reason. You know, this was at a time when the study of natural philosophy, the study of how the material world worked, was understood to be a deeply religiously infused activity. You were investigating God's creation. There was a sort of old medieval idea that there were two books, the book of Revelation, the Bible, and the book of creation, you know, the world around you, the created world that God had made that we lived in. And Newton, like many of his fellow alchemists in this sort of last great age of pre-modern alchemical research before it turned into sort of more formal chemistry, helped by people like Newton and Boyle and others, really saw that if they could crack the alchemical problem, if they could see how, you know, metals changed, if they could see how the process of change occurred in nature, they would understand, they would both understand something fundamental about how God made his creation or her creation, but also they might actually sort of see that the divine action actually working in their world. And you have to understand, Newton was deeply, passionately, and absolutely committed to a heretical view of Christianity. But it was heretical, but it was a deeply God. He had a deeply God-infused view of the world, and he thought God was still working in space, in time. That, you know, when he called the universe the sensorium of God, he meant that God extended into our material world in some actual material way. And so for him, alchemy was not something odd. It wasn't something off the track of his work. It was central to it. It was, you know, driven by the same impulses that made him want to understand the principles of motion and the principles of light. He wanted to know how God did what God does in the world that we inhabit.
Hmm. Would it be fair to say that in this period of time, in this era, that there were two revolutions underway, the scientific revolution and a financial revolution, and what kind of effects did they have on one another?
It is absolutely fair to say that. I think there's, you know, the financial historians refer to this period as the time of a great financial revolution, and certainly everybody has heard of the scientific revolution. I think they were intimately involved, and in some ways I think they were really just different aspects of the same broad phenomenon. I mean, one way to think about the scientific revolution and the financial revolution together is as an exercise in the increase of the abstraction of our explanations or our tools. So when you come up with an equation that describes both the flight of a cannonball and the motion of a planet, you've abstracted from the specific material circumstances to a general rule that allows you to cover a whole bunch of different things. And similarly, when you abstract from the idea of money as a thing, as a chunk of metal of a certain weight, with a certain design on it, and say, no, money is a piece of paper, and it can be transferred, and it may be a piece of paper that bears with it an interest rate, so you can calculate its value now versus its value in 10 years after it's paid 10 years' worth of interest. This transformation of money from a thing into a number or from a thing into an idea is directly analogous to what Newton was doing with his physics. And, you know, they also advanced by the same kinds of things. I mean, Newton worked out his theory of the tides using information from sea captains and traders and naval figures going all over the world and measuring the tides from, you know, Cornwall to the South China Sea. Literally, you can see in the Principia, his great book, records of tides from all over the world. And yet Newton himself, you know, as this famous historian of science at Cambridge, Simon Schaefer, who points out that Newton was born on an island, solved the problem of the tides, and never once saw the sea. You know, he was getting all this information from this whole network of trade and military adventures and exploration. Well, similarly, you know, a lot of the revolution in money is driven by the needs of trade and exploration and the expansion of what had been very local economies that were, you could really could be things, you could do it by barter, you didn't even need money for a very local economy, to, you know, by the time Newton's, you know, reached his 20th year in the Mint, he's writing analyses of the value of gold or silver from London to China. You know, England at that point is enmeshed in a literally global network of trade and economic relations. So, you know, I think the financial revolution and the scientific revolution are draw on many of the same impulses. They're being fought, if you take the revolution metaphor, where they're fought by the same people. I mean, the scientific revolution wasn't just Isaac Newton in a garret. It was Isaac Newton plus this enormous web of people who were measuring things or counting things all over the world, taking weather measurements or, you know, dipping tides, or even going to the islands of the South Atlantic to measure the different, slight variations in the Earth's gravity and this kind of thing. And similarly, the economic, you know, those same people often were doing the economic advances that were driving the need for new ideas of money. So the economic and the financial revolution, scientific revolution are intimately bound up together.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, author and filmmaker Thomas Levinson. He heads the graduate program in science writing at MIT. He's the author most recently of Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Lovington on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to make comment and hang up and listen if that's okay. I have a hard time hearing on this phone. It seems to me like there's a lot of, like the guy on, I don't know if you saw John Stewart, was the fellow that invented the windmill or built the windmill to build electric or to make electricity in Africa. And, you know, guys like that are probably everywhere and rarely discovered. And it seems like fellows like Newton's a lot of times, you know, they somehow had an in that made them a lot more, have a lot more influence than other people. I just wondered if you might have a comment on how Newton came to be so influential, you know, obviously politically, and that we can go love him now. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, I think it's absolutely true that there are an enormous number of creative people and certainly scientifically innovative people out there who never get celebrated. And sometimes they do have scientific careers and they do their work and they, you know, are known to their circle of fellow workers, but don't reach the public. And certainly, you know, there's a big element of luck in that. And in today's era, when you've got this sort of explosion of media and there's this enormous amount of noise, it's sometimes very hard to get a signal through. And it's just, you know, that's, you can see that there are enormously talented actors out there who never get the big break. There are, you know, fabulous violinists who are not on, who don't end up, you know, performing at Carnegie Hall and so on. But in Isaac Newton's case, he really was off the charts. The reason Isaac Newton is so celebrated is both because he had good timing. He arrived on the scene with extraordinary talents mathematically and as an experimental observer both, which is unusual in science to begin with, to be that good an experimentalist and that good a mathematician. But he also, I mean, he just was, you know, he had an enormous, his capacity for solving these problems was just better than those of his peers at that time. He was, you know, he was his miracle year, so-called, when he worked out the basis of the calculus and first started to solve the problem of gravity and so on and so forth, happened during the plague years in England in 1665 and 6, when he was 23, 24. Is that right? 40, yeah, that's right.
20, he was in his 20s, yeah.
You know, by the time he was done with that, he hadn't published anything. Nobody really knew who he was. I mean, there was one professor at Cambridge who could follow his work. But at that point already, he was more advanced in his mathematics than anyone else alive. And he'd solved a problem that had been troubling people for gone a long way to solving the problem of gravity and the motion of the planets. Hadn't entirely solved it yet. That would take more time and more work. But, you know, he was really, really quite special. But the other thing about Newton is, you know, there's only one person who gets to solve the problem how the inverse square of law of gravity governs the motions of the solar system. Once it's solved, other almost as talented people can work out, you know, can see how it's done and work out all kinds of things and do lots more work. But there's a famous quote from the Napoleonic era when a great French physicist astronomer named Laplace, who did an enormous amount of work using Newton's mathematics and Newton's ideas to do to really come to grips with how all kinds of different things move in the heavens, said, "Happy Newton, there is only one universe to discover, and he has discovered it." So he had the good luck to be there with those talents at a time when the biggest problem around was there for the taking, if only he were good enough to do it, and he was.
Yeah. Tell us about his earliest days at Trinity College, Cambridge. He came not with much.
No, he was, I mean,
In terms of resources.
Newton had a rough childhood. He wasn't you know, his family wasn't poor. I mean, they weren't fabulously wealthy either, but they were solid, comfortable yeoman farmers rising into the sort of lower country gentry. But his father died before he was born. He died during his wife's pregnancy. And she remarried. She inherited, or held in trust, really, for Newton himself, the family farm, which was a substantial enough farm to actually be still have the medieval name of a manor. So Newton was literally lord of the manor from the time he was born. But his wife was a desirable catch, still young, and she remarried when Newton was still a small child, two or three, and she moved to her new husband's house. He was a parson, a well-to-do country parson, and left Newton with Newton's grandparents at the family farm, and didn't return till her second husband died when Newton was about 10. And she was probably only semi-literate. Her brother was, she was from a wealthier family than the Newtons were, and her brother went to Cambridge and all that. But she didn't have much respect for book learning, and you know, Newton went off to grammar school in the nearby market town. But when he was done with that school, refused to even put him down for Cambridge. Said, no, you got to come back. You got to run the farm. You know, it's your manor. You're in charge. Newton was a terrible farmer. Hated it. Got distracted. You know, he'd be sent to town to do some kind of farm business, and he'd, you know, go to where he'd left his books at his old schoolmaster's house, or he'd forget himself under a tree. There are actually a couple court cases where, in his absent-mindedness, he let animals he was supposed to be minding go into a neighbor's field, and they would actually, you know, they went to law to get compensation for this. And so finally, his mom was persuaded to allow him to go to Cambridge. He'd already been seen to be a very, you know, he was the best student in his little country school, a little small town school and all that. But she gave him very, you know, even though she had plenty of money, relatively speaking, she only gave him £10 a year, which wasn't enough to pay school fees and his board. So he was forced to show up at Cambridge as what's called a subsizar, which means that in order to earn his tuition and his meals and a place to rest his head, he had to serve as a kind of servant to the richer students. You know, serve them food, carry their plates, possibly empty their chamber pots, all these, you know, odd to think of Isaac Newton, Sir Isaac Newton, this absolutely great man in history, you know, slopping about after richer men's mm-hmm. sons in his first year or two at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. It did get a little better, and certainly his talent, he won a scholarship in his third year because his talent was obvious.
Yeah.
But he started out rough.
Yeah. In this period of this horrific plague in 1665-1666, Cambridge was shuttered, so he returned to the farm, and he worked there for 2 years. What did he accomplish?
He accomplished much of the foundations of modern physics and the mathematical basis of basically all the quantitative sciences. He solved the first critical steps towards creating what's now called calculus in mathematics, which is really the mathematical study of how things change over time. And as you can see, that's critical to almost anything in science. You know, mathematics has developed, you know, much, much farther from that now. But the sort of the next development from the calculus as it was invented in the 17th century is sort of the study of differential equations, which are more complicated equations that are still solved using ideas from calculus, basically. And differential equations are all of engineering, just about, and much of physics, and all the kinds of things that build our world today. And Newton laid the foundations for that during that year. He also did the first serious physical analysis of problems of gravity. He worked out, and the critical thing he did, I mean, he did a number of things that are very important, but the critical thing he did that year was he recognized that the same force that, for example, governs falling objects on Earth, the famous, probably apocryphal apple, and anything else you drop, as it were, is the same force operating under the same law, the same relationship as that which governs things like the motions of the moon and the planets and so forth. And when he realized that what's happening here on Earth is the same thing that's happening out in the universe, that was the great sort of imaginative leap that said, we can come up with a science that will describe universal phenomena. It'll cover all of experience. It's huge. I mean, you know, one of the things that people don't realize, I think, fully enough, is how much Newton had to invent that we take for granted. There was no clear idea of inertia. The word force didn't have a clear meaning. Gravity was, could it be something that was inside a body? Was it the force, you know, was it some motive force inside something that drove it forward? Was it an attraction? Where did gravity live? I mean, all kinds of words and concepts that were so poorly understood that you couldn't even begin to frame them mathematically until you actually just pounded on them and you actually understood what you were trying to talk about. Newton had to do all that from scratch. And he did much of that in these two plague years. It's just extraordinary. And then he went on and he did things like he did his first optical experiments. This is, you know, probably when he did his prism experiments. He did experiments, I mean, really horrific ones where he, like, stuck a needle behind his eyeball to see what changing the shape of his eye would do to his vision. Because he saw the eye as an optical system. He was correct in that. So, I mean, it was just an enormously, I mean, he was a courageous person. And he really believed in doing experiments and sort of actually seeing the results for himself. The you know, yet another thing people don't know about Newton is he's one of the first people to really think about what it means to do an experiment and how to understand what the results are telling you and how to decide whether your result, you know, whether you've done it right and the results are believable. He wasn't the first person to think about this, but he was one of the early ones and a very important one. And all this was going on during those 2 years when he was sort of stuck out in the countryside trying not to get sick.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is Thomas Levinson, author most recently of Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a caller waiting for us in Atlanta, Illinois, on line 4. Hi.
People doing today?
Fine, and you?
Pretty good.
Something
that I wondered about a lot of times is that, particularly in Newton's day, with a relatively smaller population than we have today, and also the education, because of the unknowns that we know today, wasn't there. So just like you alluded to a little bit ago, he had to come a lot further than somebody might have to come today. So what I wonder about is, with our population being in the world today so much larger, better fed, and way better educated because there's more to educate people with, how come we don't produce people today on the level of the Newtons of the world, that there's several in other disciplines? We do not seem to have the genius that at that era had. I'll listen.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you. Actually, I mean, not to be, you know, contradictory, but I mean, remember Newton. You know, Newton was extraordinary. I mean, he may indeed have been the most, you know, most successful scientist ever. There has to be one. But it's true. I think it's very important to remember that he was at a point when a number of problems had been worked on and developed. To the point where somebody of extraordinary talent could in fact solve them. They weren't unsolvable. You know, a century before there was, before Descartes had worked out the first analytical geometry and showed how you could, you know, use numbers to make pictures and Cartesian coordinates and all this kind of thing. You know, Newton's particular talents may not have been as effective. I mean, he was a great geometer as well as a person who could do calculus, who helped invent calculus. So maybe he could have, but, you know, it helps to be in a place where the problems are there to solve, the right kinds of problems are there to solve. And Newton had some very big problems, and there were problems that still could be solved by a single man or a single woman's thought and effort. We have extraordinary thinkers today doing just outrageous work. I mean, I wrote a book a while back on Albert Einstein, and, you know, that's a century ago, two centuries after Newton, a century before us at this, you know, essentially. And he was extraordinary, and he had enormous gifts, and he did ideas that ranged across modern physics and have really transformed the world we live in. A half a century ago, we had Watson and Crick, very famous people. Jim Watson is still alive. Francis Crick died a couple of years ago. Crick, even more than Watson, is a remarkable sort of problem-spanning person. He helped solve both the problem of the structure of genetic inheritance, the double helix molecule of DNA, double helical structure of the molecule DNA in which the information used to build living things is stored. But he also did this extraordinary piece of work that he's less well known for outside, you know, biology, but in general, it's where he helped, he was very, very important in helping to solve how DNA actually codes its information, how you actually put together the list of instructions and mechanisms and sort of molecular machines that work together to make a human being or anything else alive. So he solved both a hardware and a software problem in an enormously broad range of different intellectual tasks and intellectual effort with an enormous impact on our world. And you can keep going. There are people who do just remarkable things. The nature and scale of the problem may not be the same as Newton's. They aren't the same as Newton's. It's harder to transform all of understanding in one fell go. There are people who still try. Stephen Wolfram is one of them. He's a fellow who invented the software program Mathematica and is trying to advance a new idea for how the universe works to organize itself. If he's right, that would be a huge thing. If he's wrong, as he most likely is, because most enormously ambitious ideas are wrong, you know, he'll still have tried something very, very difficult and very ambitious, and he's done some very remarkable things already. You know, so the critical thing is, because of the explosion of knowledge, because of how many more things there are to know in any one field to make a huge impact, it's harder to do what Newton or even Einstein or even Francis Crick did, which is have influence, outsized influence on a whole number of things. But there are still people in every generation, and I look outside my window. I'm sitting in my office at MIT right now, and I know there are some of them, you know, maybe they're just 18 right now, walking across the courtyard where I can see them, who are going to have that kind, you know, who have that kind of expansive ambition and ability. It's just that because, you know, you don't have all of physics to invent in one go, you may not think of them as Isaac Newton, but, you know, they're still enormously capable people.
Yeah. Do you think the proportion of intelligence related to population is still probably similar to what it was in Newton's day?
It might be better. I mean, again, as you point out, we have a better fed, a healthier, and better educated population, and we know that, you know, the way to get more intelligence out of the system is to pump more intelligence into it, as it were. We may, you know, it's. I wouldn't say that human ingenuity has declined since Newton's day. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Thomas Levinson, author most recently of Newton and the Counterfeiter. Well, let's talk a bit now about the man who was Newton's greatest adversary when Newton was at the Mint, William Chaloner. And you describe him as a criminal alchemist, malicious and clever, and as capable of artful wickedness. Tell us about him. What should we know about him?
I'm glad we got to Chaloner, because, you know, my book does cover, you know, a whole range of things, including the things we've been talking about. But the core of it is this wonderful true crime story, and it's wonderful because it illuminates all these other things and because it has one great character in the first scientific detective in history, Isaac Newton, and it's just delightfully bad man, William Chaloner. I mean, I'm sure it's terrible to feel such glee at the life of somebody who really did do a lot of harm to a lot of people in his day, but it really is a wonderful tale. He was born to like Newton, he was a country boy. He was born to a poor weaver the Midlands of England. And there's only one biography. It was written a few days after he was finally executed, and it's sort of this marvelous kind of early pulp, you know, true crime melodrama of a biography. But, you know, it's the source of most of the information about his early life. And apparently he was just an ungovernable child. I mean, bent to wickedness, at least as this biographer said. And so his parents sent him off at an early age to be apprenticed to a nail maker in Birmingham, which was then, you know, now it's a big industrial city. Back then it was a small market town, between 5 and 10,000 people in population. And nail makers were kind of funny, because they're kind of, you know, they're famous for being a little bit crooked themselves. It was not a very well-paid occupation. And so Birmingham nail makers were famous for actually counterfeiting, for making false coins. So it's quite possible that Chaloner got his first exposure to criminal behavior as he was an apprentice. it's certainly true that, you know, a boy whom his parents couldn't govern wasn't going to work for very low wages in a relatively unskilled shop for some other person for any length of time. So very shortly thereafter, he picked up and ran from his apprenticeship, which was a serious thing to do, and came to London. And almost immediately embarked on a criminal career, which wasn't that easy to do because, you know, London was unlike any place else in England and really anywhere else in Europe except possibly Paris. The next largest city after London was Norwich at that time, probably around 30,000 people. And then you had, you know, a few smaller towns in the 20,000 range, and then it dropped off rapidly. London was 600,000 people. It was there was nothing like it. There was no environment like it. There was nothing that stank as bad as London. I mean, think of all the animals and people and the lack of modern sewers. I mean, just put that in your head. The water was terrible. That's why everybody drank beer instead of water, weak beer, for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, because it was dangerous. You would get sick from drinking the water. Terribly deadly for children. 3 out of 5 kids died before the age of 5. I mean, this was a horrific place. Death rate exceeded the birth rate in London until the 1750s or so. And it just kept growing because these poor people would come in from the countryside desperate for a better opportunity. But that meant there was, you know, enormous competition for any scrap of work or criminal activity. And it was very hard to break in. People really guarded their sort of franchises, whether it were legal franchises like cheesemongering, controlled by 5 or 6 men who ran the cheese trade, or if it was something illegal like pickpocketing, which was organized gangs centered around given fences and certain bad pubs and so on. And Challoner had no connections with that. So he started out in London as kind of a petty pornographer, selling something that his biographer called tin watches with dildos in them, which is not exactly clear what they were, but it was something naughty. And he didn't make much money at it, but he did do what he needed to do, which is he made some loose acquaintances, bad people to hang with, and started very rapidly on a rising criminal career, going through being a quack doctor and a con man fortune teller and then a receiver of stolen goods and a recoverer of them, which was actually easy to do. It's very easy to return stolen goods to somebody if you've arranged for the theft in the first place. And he did that. And finally, he worked his way to counterfeiting, and that's where his skill really blossomed. It turned out he was very good at engraving. He became very good at engraving. He organized he understood heating metal from his days at the nail maker. And he set about producing first bad French coins and then bad English coins. And his biographer reports that he was enormously successful almost immediately at it, so much so that he was able to buy a house in a fashionable neighborhood, get a set of silver plate, that is, silver, you know, dishes and so on, which was the mark of a gentleman and so on, and abandoned his wife for a more desirable mistress and all that kind of stuff. And he looked like he was just set for life until he had the bad fortune to cross Isaac Newton, and that was a mistake.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Thomas Levinson, author of Newton and the Counterfeiter. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to join us this afternoon. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. You can hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. A few points. Very interesting conversation, but the gentleman that called earlier, I thought he had a very interesting point. I think he was getting at that there doesn't seem to be any overarching geniuses out there, which there probably are, that have made or are about to make any fundamental changes in the way we view matter, view energy. I think that's what he was getting at. If I may be facetious about it for a moment, that's probably because we don't study Latin enough. Didn't Newton write in Latin his book? That's being somewhat facetious. And another point, you used the term, you talked about gravitational force, reaching way back to my science courses. Didn't Einstein do something that there's no intrinsic force? I don't think you meant that there was an intrinsic force in matter that results in gravity or whatever. That there's not an intrinsic force, that there's something to do with the way time and space is warped and bodies move around in this whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I'll just, I'm not sure I'm being very clear about that, but I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. I mean, my answer on the question of whether or not there is genius around is the same as it was, you know, to the last caller, which is that there is still genius, but the explosion, more than anything else, the explosion in knowledge makes it harder for people to be these sort of all-encompassing geniuses where they cross many different boundaries of fields of knowledge. As to gravitation, yes. I mean, Newton's physics is expressed in terms of force. Even in Newton's own day, the meaning of the word force was still a little ambiguous. One of my MIT colleagues, the Nobel laureate physicist Frank Wilczek, wrote a wonderful essay that you can track down on the Physics Today website. I don't have the URL in front of me. On the curious nature, whence the F in F equals MA? What did Newton really mean by force? And it's available online. It's collected in a couple places as well. That goes into this question in some detail. But Newton really did, sort of postulate the idea that there is this action at a distance. There's a mutual attraction between two bodies, to begin with, that exerts a force that produces motion in the bodies under gravitational attraction, and that this force is proportional to the masses of the two objects divided by the distance squared between them. And it is absolutely true that Einstein came along and said, no, this notion of this sort of occult force somehow leaping from one object to another isn't correct. You have to think about it in terms of the concept of the field, and the field in this case, the field is, you know, defined by space-time as its shape is warped by the presence of matter or energy within it. And it's the bends and curves caused by the presence of a big object like the sun that creates a big warp in space-time that we roll around and perceive as gravity. And then, you know, since then, people have been attempting to apply the insights and ideas of quantum mechanics to refine the notion of what gravitation really is even further. But the truth of the matter is that Newton's approximation and Newton's sort of mental image of this mutual attraction between two bodies works pretty well for everyday life. You know, it's as you know, Newton's law of gravitation actually drops out of the Einstein field equation as long as you're not dealing with masses that are too dense or too large, or speeds or energy or speeds that are too high. So you know, you get Newton's perception of gravity works pretty well for most of what we do.
Once in government service, did Newton ever return to scientific pursuits?
He went into government service not intending to be a full-time civil servant. He was promised. I mean, there's a letter from the Chancellor of the Exchequer says, you know, here's this great job. It's a sinecure. We want you to come up to London, and you won't have to show up any more than you want to. It turned out not to be the case, especially for the first few years, because of this currency crisis and the wave of counterfeiting and this need to remake all of England's currency in as quickly as possible. It took Newton about 20 months to do it. But he did continue to do intellectual work after he went to London. He continued to work on some problems in physics. He worked very hard on the problem of the motions of the moon, which is an example of the three-body problem because the sun, the moon, and the earth are all involved in a mutual gravitational attraction. And it proved intractable. It's a very deep and complicated problem and wasn't properly solved until almost the end of the 19th century by a French mathematician named Poincaré. And he continued, he did a tiny little bit of alchemy once he got to London, almost nothing. He wrote a lot, he put together all his work on optics and light and put that together in a book he published about 8 years after he got to London. And he did some more speculations on the theory of matter and this kind of thing. But for the most part, his scientific energy was pretty much, you know, run out by the time he got to London, which is not uncommon. I mean, remember, 1696, he would have been 54. And most scientists, most mathematicians, tend to have completed the most vibrant period of their work by then. Newton had actually a longer career at the sort of real edge of knowledge than very many scientists since have been able to achieve. And most of what he did after that, and he worked prodigiously, writing constantly, was centered on problems of history of the prophets, and religious questions. So he wrote he attempted to calculate the end of days. He attempted to write a proper history of the early years of the church. And he was very, very involved in this work. It wasn't nearly as productive. He wasn't anywhere near as good a historian as he was a physicist, but he worked pretty tirelessly almost to the moment of his death.
Yeah. One of the surprises for me in this book, and there are many, is at the close when you say before his death he offered his own version of an epitaph. And you say this is perhaps his most famous moment of self-reflection, but what a stunner to me. He's so modest.
Well,
I guess that says something about why he was always working.
I think that's true. I mean, he, as much as anyone and more than most, knew that for all that he had discovered or worked out, how much there was left unknown. And, you know, it's still true. We live in an era of enormous scientific advance, much, you know, great advance over Newton's day, great advance over, you know, when I was a boy, longer ago than I like to think. But it's really remarkable when you realize how hard it is to figure out critical things about the world. You know, nature does not let go its secrets easily. And you can revel in the fact of how much more we understand about ourselves and the planet and the organization of the universe and the way matter interacts with other matter and all these kinds of things that scientists are concerned with. And we do know, I mean, it's this enormously vibrant and rich and exciting era, and it's one that in some senses started, you know, in and around Isaac Newton and other figures of his era. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, I was just reading a book that's talking about some of the critical issues in the early history of cellular biology in the last 20 years or so. I remember when Richard Nixon launched the war on cancer, and we know an enormous amount more about cancer now than we did then, but cancer is still very much with us. We have not cured cancer in 5 years, as Nixon had suggested his program would lead to. You know, we know an enormous amount about the universe. We can trace back the evolution of our universe from where we are now back to within tiny fractions of a second after the singularity out of which our universe or our part of the universe emerged. And yet we know that there are these enormous, you know, mysteries still out there. What is this thing called dark matter? What is this thing called dark energy? If there is a multiverse, if there's more than one, you know, expanded sort of opened up area of space time, how are they? You know, how do they form? Where are they? I mean, it's kind of a meaningless question. These, you know, enormous mysteries that, despite the fact that we know so much more than we knew, you know, say before 1964, when the first signs of the Big Bang were detected, the first direct evidence of the Big Bang was detected by two guys working with a funny old antenna in New Jersey. You know, I think Newton wasn't modest in that he didn't think that he was absolutely central to the critical developments in natural philosophy of his day. He knew how important his work was. He never had any doubt about it. That's why he fought so bitterly with some of his fellow scientists over the priority to certain discoveries. But at the same time, Newton knew perhaps better than we do today, how much there remains to be discovered.
And that's where we have to leave it. We're out of time. Thomas Levinson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thomas Levinson is the author of Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. This is his latest book. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
You've been listening to an archive edition of The Afternoon Magazine with your host, Celeste Quinn. That taken, of course, from late in the last year. You can hear more from Celeste each and every day right here on Public Radio, AM 580 WILL, during the 1 o'clock hour. Time now to take a look at the numbers as they finished up in Chicago. I'm Todd Gleason from University of Illinois Extension. In the soft red winter wheat pit this afternoon, a 499.5 top for the day, the low at 490, settlement price at 492.75. Down 13.75. May of 517 top, bottom at 501, settled 504.5, 14.75 lower in July wheat. The harvest month, $5.29.5 the high, the low at 13.75, settled at $5.16.75. Down 14.5 cents. July hard red at 521, down 10.75 from the corn pit. Nearby March contract today at 381 top, bottom at 69.25, settled at $3.70.75. March corn futures a loss today. today, down 7.25 cents. May futures 392, the high, the low at 380.25. Settlement price at 381.75, down 7.25. And July contract 402.25, the high, the low at 391. Settlement price at 392.5, down 7.25. September futures 409, the high, the low at 398.25. Settlement price at 399.75, down 6.25. And December contract 415.5, the high, the low at 404.5. Settlement price at 406.5, down 6.5. That in the December corn contract. March futures at 425, the high, the low at 415. This is the 2011 futures. March contract at 416.75, down 6.25 on the Monday afternoon. March oat futures 224.25, the high, the low at 216. Settlement price at 220.5, down a half, and the May contract down a penny at $2.29.5. Soy complex March beans, $9.59 the top, the bottom at 44. Settlement price there at $9.52.5, 1.5 cents higher on the day. May futures were up as well, 9.68 the high, the low at 53.5. Settlement price at $9.62.5, up a penny and a half. July contract from the bean pit, $9.76 the high, the low at 62. Settlement price at 9.70.5, up 1.5, and the August contract 9.69.25, the high, the low at 57. Settlement price at 9.66.25, and the oil seeds up a penny for the soybeans in Chicago at the CME. September contract a penny higher today, 9.55.25, the high, the low at 46.75. Settlement price at 9.52.5, up 1. And finally, the November contract up a penny and a half today, 9.45.25, the high, the low at 34.25. Settlement price for new crop soybeans, 9.42.5, up 1.5 cents in the November contract. March bean meal at 273.90 top on the afternoon, the bottom at 268.50. Settlement price there at 271, down $2.20. And the March bean oil up 21 cents, 39.69 the high, the low at 39.19. Settlement price at 39.50. March soybean oil up 21 for the day. April live cattle futures from the CME Group, 92.15 the high, the low at 91.50 for the livestock. Settlement price 91.72.5. Live cattle futures down 20 cents. It's the only loser across the floor there. June live cattle 90.70 the high, the low at 90.25. A settlement price 20 cents higher at $90.60 a hundredweight. And the August contract 89.45 the high, the low at 88.75. Settlement price $89.40. Up 57.5 cents. October live cattle futures $92 the high, the low at 91.42.5. Settlement price at 91.97.5. Up 42.5 cents. March feeder cattle 102.10 the high, the low at 101.25. Settlement price at $102.10, a dollar and a nickel higher. April contract 103.80 for the feeders on the high, the low at 102.65. Settlement price at $103.65, up $1.15. In the May contract 104.65 the high, the low at 103.70. Settlement price at 104.50, a gain today of $1.05. August feeder cattle 106.50 the high, the low at 105.45. The August feeders settled at $106.47.5, up $1.22.5. April lean hogs today, 73.55 the top, the bottom there at 72.70. Settlement price at 72.95, up 15 in the May. 78.50 for the high, the low at 77.80. Settlement price 78.47.5, up 55 cents. June contract $82 the high, the low at 81.15. Settled 81.97, up 57.5 cents. July futures in the live hogs, or rather lean hogs, 81.30, the high, the low at 80.30. Settlement price 81.27.5, up 80 cents. And the pork bellies today, $2.77.5 the gain, 92.22.5 the high, the low at 91.70 for the March. Settlement price at $92 even, up $2.77.5 in the May contract there, 94.30 the high, the low at 91.50. A settlement price at $94.20, up $2.90. You are listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 in Urbana.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating, and machinery loans.